Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, birders. Hello, friends. Welcome back. We are Life List, a birding podcast. I'm George Armistead here with both my co-hosts, Molly Brown and Alvaro Jaramillo. Guys, what's going on?
Hey.
Hello. Lots going on. Migration, really? Birds. Yeah, it's still kind of coming down from the pelagics and working up to the ones that are coming up this weekend. So, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, it's raining here. I don't know about you, Molly. We're getting, it's kind of a gloomy fall day. I actually didn't really look at the forecast and set my alarm early. I was thinking I'm going to go out back and do a little pre-dawn listening. And then I got all ready, got out of bed, got dressed, went to the back door and was like, oh, I'm not doing that.
That's funny. Yeah, we're kind of between storms here right now, but it was that way here this morning too. And this was my free morning and I'd wanted to get out and I slept in instead. So I did look at the weather.
Yeah, that would have been a wise move on my part. Well. Kristen and I binged The Bear last night a bit. Have you guys seen that show?
Oh, that's the cooking show?
Yeah, yeah.
I really want to watch.
I like it. Yeah, Kristen's a little less in love with it, but I think it's a good show.
Oh, like emotionally intense?
Yeah, well, it's just kitchen, high stress, a lot of people yelling, a lot of profanity, a lot of strong personalities clashing together. I'm into it, but Kristen's not as, she doesn't love it as much as I do. I'm not sure. I might be watching this one on my own going forward.
Huh.
Yeah.
I thought you're talking about that Cocaine Bear movie. I want to see that.
Yeah.
That's more my style.
Yeah. That's I was going to say, that's sort of a biopic about you right now.
Yeah. No, maybe Dorian.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe Dorian. Yeah. That's probably more appropriate. Yeah. Yeah. No, I got a new toy, guys. I got a new Zoom field recorder for recording stuff, and I'm kind of looking forward to trying to get nocturnal migrants as they go over at night doing some live listening. It's got a 6-second buffer on it. So before I'd be out there with my phone trying to catch stuff and then I'd miss it, but with the 6-second buffer on this field recorder, I can kind of always be recording and then hit record and then get whatever, was going the 6 seconds or so beforehand. And I will say my first night of trying that a couple nights ago was a big migration night. I could see with my thermal, I could see birds, lots of birds moving over really, really high up. And some of them, they were so high, I wasn't sure really if all of them were birds, but given the volume and that a lot seemed to be headed generally south, I assumed most were birds. Some might be bats, but it was a lot of birds, but they were so high, I could not hear them, and I failed to record a single flight call. So I think I'm going to need some weather to force stuff down a little bit. I don't know how that's going to work in fall. I was talking to a friend of mine. He says spring is actually much better around here. Things tend to migrate lower then. But at any rate, yeah, that's the new toy I have in it. And I'm going to need some help from the weather, I think, for it to really go good.
Huh. It's really cool. Hey. I haven't used those recorders at all. Does it work with your phone? Is it a standalone thing?
It's a standalone, and I've got an old Sennheiser shotgun microphone that I've had kind of laying around for a few years, and I'm kind of using that to listen with headphones and then record anything that I hear. Secretly, I was hoping for upland sandpiper as a yardbird, which would be pretty amazing.
If you're really keen on doing it just from the backyard, you should probably get yourself a parabola.
I was thinking but I actually talked to our buddy Dan Lane and some others, and they were saying because you're in the city, you might actually be better off with a shotgun mic because of all the other ambient noise around. But I think I'd like to try that, Al, and just see,
Doesn't the parabola, work a little differently on different frequencies, and it's not as good at collecting up the low frequencies, sort of the hum of the city, as much as the high pitches, or am I wrong?
I don't know. I am new to this game, so that is a good question that perhaps we can put to our brain trust. But I'd like to give it a try because it would give me a wider field to catch stuff. The issue I have here are dogs nearby and the occasional, like, what sounds like basically a drag racer dude. I'm convinced it's the same guy every time. Usually, like, you know, 9 at night or so, and I'll be out there listening, and this guy will just, like, tear around like crazy. And I've entertained various fantasies about how I might slow him down, but I shan't. I shan't follow through on any of those.
There's some military gear that will pop tires.
Some tactical gear you can recommend.
Hey, Molly, were you using the plug-in thermal? Have you seen this?
Oh, used on live?
You know what I mean? Like, so phone, and you plug in the little doohickey.
I'm gonna have to look up what it's called. It's not mine. It's Josh Coville's, but we used them side by side for several nights last week, or the week before when we were in Arizona. It was really cool. So rather than like the kind of handheld, mono thermals that a lot of folks in birding are using now, this is solely a lens that plugs into your phone, and it just uses a phone app. So it's like tiny, tiny. I think it's at a much lower price point than all of these other thermals too. So it's really fascinating. It worked pretty well. We were kind of comparing the quality of what he had and what I had. So it's like a fixed, 2x focal length, which is good. You don't need a lot of zoom for these thermals because you're really just detecting movement. It's not like you're looking at the details like you are during the day. Mine starts at a 2.5 and you can zoom in more, but I pretty much never do that. And so he had a wider field of view and it picked up almost the same quality and resolution as what I had. I think I had a little bit of an advantage on that. I have the cheapest model of the Pulsar Axiom, which is a popular thermal that folks are using these days, I think, in birding.
What did you say the magnification was on his?
His was 2x. I think 2.5 on mine. So it's just on his screen. So it's really cool. And it's really difficult, especially if you're in a group or not by yourself, to be like using one of these thermals and you can see something really clearly and, you know, pitch black and nobody else around you can see it, of course. So it's like difficult to explain where it is and pass it off and all of that. And you don't have any of those things. And it's a lot easier to find stuff when you're just looking at your phone screen. So, it was pretty awesome. Of course, it uses up your phone. So then if you're like taking pictures of stuff or, I don't know, doing anything else, then that's a disadvantage if you're going to be plugging it in. So there was some give and take, but we had a lot of fun with it. We were out, we broke it in pretty well.
That sounds good. Cause actually it's way cheaper.
It's like $400 and that's probably the only thing under $1,000.
I saw a review of it elsewhere and, I think it was the Mammal Watching podcasts. They had a review on it and I was intrigued and I didn't know Josh had got it. And then I saw that post. I was like, oh, those guys are using that. That is cool.
Just got it.
Yeah. And yeah. I think, yeah, for, if it's reasonably close stuff, there's, it sounds like it's, it can do the job.
And for travel, I think some governments don't want you to move, you know, get those thermal scopes in their country. This thing doesn't look like one, you know, it just looks like a little lens. So,
Totally. Looks like a little camera lens or something you attach. It's called the Infrared Smartphone Thermal Eye.
Nice. Cool. So, if you're looking for like stuff that's relative, like, I mentioned, I was looking for like migrant songbirds and some of these were way the heck up there. I don't know how high. Not every thermal would be well designed for that. But if you're looking for mammals or close small owls and stuff, which is probably what most folks would be looking for, this would be very, very useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't think it would hold up the same looking for migration at night, that sort of thing. But we were just driving around looking at mammals and low deciduous growth, that sort of thing, or the, you know, mixed pines in the canyons in Arizona and around there. And it was awesome.
Molly, maybe you just got back from the Southeast Arizona Birding Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And then you took a trip from there. You guys, a gang of you guys, kind of headed south.
Yep.
I was very envious of that route you took. Maybe you want to tell folks a little bit about the fest and your trip.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I go to Arizona. It's pretty much become the thing that I do, to go to that festival each year. I don't know what, it's maybe my sixth time going. It's been a lot. But it's been really fun because over the past few years, there's been a group of friends, basically, that, of course, you know a lot of people at these festivals too, but we've all kind of gotten intentional about making this the one that we all get together at. And we rent a big house and kind of plan stuff together, and then add on a few days after or before and do these other things too. So it's really, really fun. And I mean, there's a reason we go there. One, because Tucson Audubon's really fantastic at putting on this festival. It is so, so good. They just provide all sorts of opportunities for really cool activities, birding, field trips, workshops, speakers, socializing, like you name it. So that's really nice. And you're in a really, really cool area that's just got all sorts of things to do. We never get to all the birds we want to see by a long shot. And we're always kind of picking and choosing which areas we want to focus on that year. So that's just wonderful. It's so, so cool there. It's really cool to see the monsoons
this year.
The headliners were Phil Schoen.
Phil, who just completed a second book on habitats, this one on habitats of North America.
Yeah, he just completed it, and it's coming out early next year. So yeah, he was giving a talk on habitats too. Arjan
Duarheis.
Yeah, I've heard his name so many different ways. Yes, he did the big year last year. He was the main keynote, and he did the big banquet and everything too. And I got to hang out with him. We got our Life Gila Monster together this year, so that was really, really fun. Man. And he's so cool. He got some like life birds there and was all excited about that. And he was really, really fun to hang out with. So
nice.
Good stuff.
He's got a new book out on that. Big year, I know. My dad's reviewing it. I forget for what publication, but it sounds like it's a good read.
Yeah, I'm really excited to read it. I haven't yet, but he's a really cool guy, and everything he did in his big year is pretty fantastic. So I'm sure there's plenty of good things to read in there. We were all talking as we were kind of planning out our week in Arizona. This year, things kind of flipped for us as a group, where in general, we plan our mornings and where we want to go birding, and we kind of, you know, fit in everything else around that. But this time around, we were planning what we were doing at night and where we wanted to go herping and looking for mammals and owls and nightjars and everything too. And nights took the main priority slot for us, which was really fun. Kind of rediscovering a lot of things or catching up on things that we've just overlooked before as we're getting more into lots of different things besides birds. And that was really, really fun.
What kind of stuff did you guys, what herps? And I didn't hear about any buff-colored nightjars around this year. I don't know. And they might be quiet by now. But
yeah. Well, for buff-colored nightjars, one reason that we didn't target them, and I don't actually know if folks were finding them much during the festival or not, is because went down to Sonora and more south into Mexico after that, which is prime habitat for things like buff-colored nightjar. Yeah, trogons, elegant trogons, sulfur-bellied flycatchers, those types of things that just barely get up into southeast Arizona. And you kind of look at that as like the singular area in the U.S. where you can get these birds. But you keep going south and you get to where they're, you know, thriving, and they're not just existing in like, I don't know, this little riparian habitat up in one canyon on a reliable basis or something like that. So, yeah, it was really cool to get into the heart of some of that Madrean habitat and see all of that down there. But for other things that we were looking at night, first off, we've all been talking for a while about the mammals that we've seen and that sort of thing. So like kangaroo rats and jackrabbits and that sort of thing, and finding them and actually making sure that we were all looking at the same species, lots of different ground squirrels and those types of things through there too. And kind of catching up on things that like we thought we'd seen before but hadn't confirmed, or, you know, we knew what we were looking for a little bit more like that. Dove into some of the mice that were through there and that sort of thing. Herp-wise, just about anything that crossed the road. And that was kind of it was mainly by car that we were looking for snakes and that sort of thing. So many young rattlesnakes just on the road at night, just crazy. And you get out on these trails, at least I do, it's incredible that there are so many around. Just the quantity of snakes really amazes me.
You see some black-tailed rattlers?
Didn't have black-tailed this year. But a lot of what we were doing was sort of more in the desert and the Sonoran loops and that sort of thing. So Mojaves that I think have a little bit of a wider range.
Diamondbacks?
Yeah, diamondbacks were probably the most common for what we saw. Yeah. And then we went out and we targeted Gila monsters and had a really good night with that. So that was awesome. Yeah. Banded geckos out there. We got that. Wow. Fun stuff. Lots of toads. So yeah, great festival all around. Lots of good food down there and that sort of thing too. So we did that and the festival ended and we all kind of packed up and went separate ways. And a few of us headed farther south and did the Sonora route, which was you drive down to the border south of Tucson. So that's, I don't know, an hour or so to Nogales. And then we rented a car on the Mexico side and then drove like about an 8-hour drive, I think. Pushing 300 miles. We stopped and of course did some birding and stuff along the way, but really got down to the bottom of the state of Sonora and stayed in the town of Alamos and spent 4 nights there and just did a lot of that Western Mexican endemic birding and that sort of thing. It was really cool. My first real trip in Mexico that was like thoroughly birding an area. So that was really, really fun. It was extremely hot. And we weren't as high up as we were in Arizona. In Arizona, the heat wasn't much of a problem at all, really, because we just...
So did you just miss those, like that streak of like 20 days or whatever it was, where it was like 110 degrees or something every day?
You know, it was definitely warmer the week or two before we were there. I think the highs were still well above 100, but a couple things. One, we're not out in the middle of the day for the most part because we're birding in the morning, and then we're getting up into higher elevations for most of what we were looking for. And that's where, I mean, if you're really going to thoroughly bird every habitat in that area, you're going to spend some time down in the desert, but we were doing that mostly at night. So overall, it just kind of works out. I'm very heat intolerant, but I was totally fine there and pretty much always have been. So it was all just fine. The temperatures were lower down in Alamos. Like the highs were mid-90s, but it was so humid. And man, it was hot. And it wasn't raining at that point. We kind of took off right before the hurricane was coming up. We were like a day and a half ahead of it as we were coming back up and heading home. So we didn't catch any of that. But there was a little bit of cloud cover here and there. I mean, we managed. We did a lot of hiking.
That's awesome. A lot of time on foot.
Yeah, so we were out there and luckily prepared for the lots and lots of water and electrolyte and that sort of thing to get through the day. But the birding was really, really cool. It felt exciting because it's an area that isn't birded a ton, especially in August. We were ahead of migration, but it just a lot of elements of discovery and just going out and figuring out what's there, that sort of thing. And that was pretty fun.
Nice. Yeah. That's a big hole in my biogeography zones that I've hit. I haven't really done much in that part of the world, so I'd like to do it at some point.
Yeah, you know, Mexico's got a lot of endemics and a lot of unique things and all over the country. We hadn't covered the west side of the Baja Peninsula there, but just the east side of that in the state, there's tons of unique birds and hard to see birds and that sort of thing. So
anything in particular you guys were after bird wise, or were you just kind of more exploring the area? Or
my main targets were one military macaw, which was really, really painful because it was a herd only. It was flying over and we just couldn't get on it quick enough in the trees or through the trees as we were hiking. But we heard it. So it's just cool to be in their presence. That was really cool. Otherwise, I was really looking forward to finding some corvids that were there, and magpie jays were quite common. They were around our hotel and in a lot of different habitats that we were in. It's black-throated. So that was awesome. They were really great. We spent a whole morning looking for purplish-backed jays and lucked out on a few of them that were down in the lowlands there, and that was really fun. Another big target that we worked for a lot and ended up lucking into just in the moment was a blue mockingbird. And they're, I think, pretty hard to see anywhere. We knew we were in the right spot for them, but like I said, August, that time of year, a hot year, it's hard to get up into the highest elevations there and kind of get into the pine habitat, but it was right at the top of the dry forest and one just popped up as we were, you know, working our way through. So those were some highlights. I think I had about 160 species over almost 4 days of birding. So that's kind of to gauge that.
Any Aztec thrushes?
No. No.
That'd be my most wanted bird around that.
Yeah.
I've never seen one of those. I've missed them many times.
Yeah, it was one that we knew we could luck out on, but yeah, didn't this time. I think if you go a little bit further south, your odds are even better, though. Maybe that'll be next year.
So one in Madera Canyon once. I think it was in August, but...
makes sense.
Yeah.
I want to say just quickly, if you know, that the week before that festival, there's a Southwest Wings festival in Sierra Vista, and I went to that. So I wasn't at your festival, but I was at the other festival. And somebody who wanted to go kind of multi-festival
could double up, right?
Yeah, could double up. It's actually, they're close to each other in different places. You know, Sierra Vista is where Southwest Wings is based. I gave a talk there on blackbirds, and the hosts, Chris Harvard and Mary Say, are great. It's a small festival. But with a lot of adventures, things you can do, sort of.
Sierra Vista is well located for great birding.
And we had you know, during my talk thing, you know, we had dinner with the mayor and his wife, and Sierra Vista is planning next year of having like a month long celebration as the hummingbird capital of the United States.
That's right. So I was just trying to remember that. Doesn't it like say that on their like the sign of like the town or something that says like hummingbird capital of the US or something?
But it's interesting that the mayor is into this. You know, they're kind of really into the whole thing, and they were actually, you know, asking questions about birds, and you know, that apparently they're kind of into it. Which is neat to see, because, you know, Sierra Vista is really a military town, you know, when you think about it. But it's kind of shifting a little bit to the tourism and so forth. But anyway, back-to-back, two festivals, 1 week apart, essentially, one could do it and spend a couple of weeks in Arizona getting sort of expertly guided walks and talks and all that, so...
And I think a lot of people hear about Arizona in August and they do think about the heat, but Molly, your point is a good one, which is that a lot of the time you're middle of the day, you're not actually birding. You spend your mornings often up at higher elevation, sometimes in the sky islands there, as they call it, or the, you know, the various mountain ranges. So you can spend a lot of time in pretty really nice areas where the weather is actually pretty pleasant, and then take a break midday and do the festival stuff, and then maybe get out again early evening, or just take it easy and get some good food, some good Mexican food or whatever floats your boat, maybe some drinks with friends. Pretty good time to be had there.
Oh yeah, I mean it when I say I don't like hot weather, and I'm fine there. I think I very intolerant of that. But another really cool thing about that area that would work well if you're combining the festivals is there are a lot of really nice bird-focused bed and breakfasts and little places to stay that are so, so fun. And there's not a ton of that in the U.S. that gives you the feels that you have in, you know, other parts of the neotropics, but you can do that there.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of places with hummingbird feeders and so forth that you can stay at. B&Bs. Yeah. Or right adjacent to famous birding spots where you can roll out of bed and walk over to, you know, Ramsey Canyon or whatever. It's a,
yeah,
pretty neat. Yeah,
it is.
Plan everybody for next year.
Yes. Yeah. I'd like to go too. I've been to the Southeast Arizona Birding Festival once, and Luke Safford, who runs it, does an excellent job. I'd really like to get back there. So we'll see, maybe things will dovetail and can make it next year. I'd like to go just to see everybody.
Yeah, your whole Hillstar crew was there without you.
I know. It was. I was like, I felt like everybody was there. I was like, man.
We kind of were.
It'd be awesome. Awesome to do it again with a good bunch. But,
so you guys were talking about heat. This is I just came up on this story today. I forgot even when we were just sort of planning this episode. But I heard about it on the radio, and I wanted to look it up. And it's pretty troubling. But so it turns out, I don't know if you heard about this, that one of the colonies of emperor penguins, in 2022, they have satellite photos of the penguin and penguin colony, which is on sea ice, you know, and it all broke apart before the penguins could leave.
Oh God!
And they estimate that 10,000 young birds were killed. Jeez. By the melting sea ice in this certain part of, it's called Smiley Island, the colony. I heard it on BBC, and there's an article on it online right now, that just, you know, a few hours ago. But I thought this was crazy because, of course, these areas where the colony set up are areas of ice that kind of never break up, you know? So troubling, to say the least. They do think that overall these kinds of colonies might produce 3,000 young that actually fledge. So many of them die anyway, but still it's thousands of young penguins that have not made it. That's which awful. I thought was sad, obviously, but worth telling people about.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, when you still have people out there thinking this doesn't exist.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
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 God, that's crazy. A sad story. Yeah. Uh-huh.
They usually pledge 3,000?
Yeah. I think they estimate there were 10,000 present at the time.
Huh.
But that usually 3,000 fledge from this colony. I think that's what the numbers are. But they estimate that 10,000 actually died because they were too young to succeed just swimming around. And the pictures of the colony are basically, you know, ice and then, you know, just water. So it's just, they were gone. So it's crazy, very, very troubling what's going on with the ice. On that happy note.
Smiley Island. Yeah, really.
Not so smiley. Yeah. Okay, so can I shift to something a little goofier?
Please,
then?
Yes. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So last, you know, I don't know in what order all of these recordings we've done will come out in, but, you know, the last one with Glenn Bartley, we were laughing at Canadian content, you know, like that, since he's Canadian and all that. But did you know, and I want to bring up a topic that divides people. It really does divide people. And this is pizza. You know, we've talked about pizza that isn't pizza, right, George?
We certainly have. Yes.
But pizza with Hawaiian type toppings, right? The classic, you know, pineapple pizza.
Yeah.
Was invented in Canada. It was invented in the town of Chatham, which is near, kind of between, it's near Rondeau Provincial Park. It's a good birding area. In 1962, by a Greek-born Canadian that
you're
said...
I'm sorry, you're talking about Hawaiian pizza?
Hawaiian pizza was invented in Canada. And he called it Hawaiian pizza because of the brand of pineapple chunks that he was using. It was pineapple chunks that, you know, the can was just said Hawaiian. So he called it Hawaiian pizza, but it's a Canadian invention, which I know some people hate.
Oh yes.
And some people love. And it is so hated, in fact, that the president of Iceland at one point told a group of high school students that he was fundamentally opposed to putting pineapple on pizza. And he joked that he would ban pineapple as a pizza topping if he could.
That's strong leadership right there, in my opinion. Strong leadership. Yeah.
And I think Justin Trudeau, Canadian Prime Minister, expressed support by saying, I have a pineapple, I have a pizza, and I stand behind this delicious Southwestern Ontario creation. Ugh. I don't think he took a stand at that point. I think he was basically saying, I like pineapple and I like pizza, but it was a very political answer. But I don't know. So you do not like pineapple on your pizza.
There's
this fine Canadian invention.
Oh, God. There's only one acceptable position on this. There's only one.
There's only one? Really?
Yeah.
Are we taking a trip to Philly now?
I like pineapple a lot. I love me some pineapple. I love me some pizza. Together, it's gross, and I just don't understand it. And this came up quite a lot in Colombia this year, actually. And it is apparently there also a very divisive issue. People have strong opinions on both sides. Of course, only one side is really got standing.
Australia thinks you're wrong, George, because in Australia, pineapple Hawaiian type pizza is the most popular pizza flavor type. In Australia. It's still only 15%, but you know, that is the majority, the most popular pizza type that is ordered in Australia. So I guess you won't be doing any Australia tours anytime soon, George, since
my mother raised me
banned.
My mother raised me and said that if you don't have anything nice to say, sometimes it's best not to say anything at all.
Says a guy who has a podcast. But what's your stand, Molly? What do you think? What do you think about this pizza with pineapple Canadian concoction?
I like pineapple on pizza. I don't like ham, actually. So I don't usually get Hawaiian pizza because I don't like ham. But I like pineapple on pizza.
Okay. So I agree with – see, I disagree with George in this because he thinks there's only one stand. Mm-hmm. And I won't necessarily order Hawaiian pizza, but if it's served to me, I don't mind it at all. Like – so it's not my preferred, but I eat it and I enjoy it.
I see. That's weird. You know? Like I can
you
eat
prefer it,
but I can eat it, but I do not enjoy it. Yeah.
So we have the three levels here. Molly prefers it. You hate it, and I will eat it, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I don't know. No opinion might be the worst opinion in this case.
Yeah.
I know, since it is a fine Canadian invention, maybe I should just say I love it, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's no position. Reasonable people can have. Sorry, Molly.
Our local place, I get the pineapple pizza. It's pineapple bacon. It's like good crispy bacon and red onion. And I like that combo.
Yeah. I love two out of those three. Yeah.
Yeah,
I did just see that Martin Seltzer sent me that they have now here in Philadelphia issued tomato pie flavored potato chips.
Nice.
And that these are apparently extremely, extremely popular in the short amount of time that they've been available. So you see, in a potato chip, this strikes me as a reasonable thing. This is something I would try. So
in a potato chip.
Yeah, I mean, I have a bit
in
of a
potato chip.
Yeah. I have a bit of a chip problem. Like I have been asked occasionally to get out of people's cars while eating potato chips because I have trouble eating one at a time. Like they kind of just kind of like smash them into my face.
So I'm suddenly troubled that, you know, you are so close-minded when given options of round pizza type things with, you know, you can't do it with that. You don't want the tomato pie. You don't want the Hawaiian pizza. You basically are restricting yourself to the most restrictive little aspect of the pizza family. And I've always thought, George, you were an open-minded person. And in fact, this is obviously a meter of open-mindedness, and you're not coming out well on this one, George. I don't know.
You are entitled to your opinion, Elmer. But I think what really makes
it's not opinion, it's fact.
What really makes us in this world are the things that we love and the things that we really dislike. I think those are good markers to be aware of. So I'm just trying to be a clear communicator.
Let's talk about something much less troubling, which is Impidnax identification.
All right. Yes. That was a smooth transition there. I like that. That's good. Yeah. Well, I just showed you guys. I did just get this book, Field Guide to North American Flycatchers, The Impidnax and the Peewees by Sintai Lee and illustrated by Andrew Birch. I wanted this in part because tis the season, as they say. It is mid-August here, late August now. And almost every time I go out, I am seeing a non-vocal Impidnax flycatcher. And we have willows breed around here, Acadians breed around here, but everything else passes through, at least of the eastern species, and even occasionally of the western ones. And man, if you look at eBird, the percentage of Impidnax that are ID'd and confidently ID'd, at least around here, and I suspect more broadly, seems way too high to me. I feel like there should be way more Impidnax spuzz or trails flycatchers or slashes. And, you know, as someone who has spent some time looking at birds, I was like, I would love to see something new, particularly on impits, but also on wood peewees. I've been in places where people feel really confident in separating wood peewees visually, and I have never reached that point myself. But this is a pretty great little new addition, I would say, this book, and I'd recommend it for folks. But Al, I know you were a reviewer when this book was still kind of towards the end of its building.
Yeah, pre-printing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you see this as a different kind of thing?
I think the concept's really good because what it does, it uses illustrations, and some of them, it almost repeats the same illustrations to give you a different story. So it'll say, this is what a short wing looks like. This is what a medium wing looks like. This is what a long wing looks like. And then you go, oh, okay, that's what they're talking about. Or this is what, you know, a broad bill, a narrow bill looks like. And it kind of takes you through each one of the features. This is what a skinny tail looks like. And this is what a fat tail, broad tail looks like. So then it uses the illustrations to set up almost like a menu of features, how you assess them. And then it says, okay, well, here's a least. This is a broad billed, you know, narrow tailed, short winged flycatcher. And then it's like, boom, 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 you know, versus a Hammond's is a, you know, small billed, long winged, small, short tailed, you know, and it kind of does this shape thing in a really great way that simplifies it. So you can, you know, go through this sort of ABCD and kind of whittle it down. And then you can narrow it even further by making sure the plumage features were all match up and what the variation is and so forth. So I thought it was really good concept. Like I liked the idea of not just showing everything exactly the same and making you compare images, but in fact, taking features and comparing them within the genus. And then so saying, okay, you know, this is how this one stands out. Now, there is like a chart they have of all the features that I found really confusing. As in, you know, in fact, I would maybe not have included that because it's sort of like this massive chart of, yeah, sort of that I found almost a little too much. My brain doesn't work that way. But if it's just the simple visual that they did, I thought it was great.
The other thing I like about it is that it's not overly text heavy. You know, there's negative space on a lot of these mm-hmm. pages such that you can kind of focus in on what they're really trying to show you and talk about. So they're not trying to overload you with minutia too much. And then as you were saying, Al, they kind of begin with these illustrations which show four different crown shapes, and they show which then they have the round crown, flash yeah, crown, peaked right. crown, crested crown, and they show which species fall into each category. Same thing with forehead angle, bill length,
yeah.
lower mandible color, tail length, primary projection, wing bar contrast. Because, I mean, especially in Pitanex, I really don't think – I think everyone would agree that probably there's mm-hmm. no more challenging group of – birds to identify. If they're vocalizing, it's pretty straightforward, but a lot of the time they're not, especially in migrants and vagrants, and then we really got our work cut out for us.
Yeah. And if you're thinking, why did they include the Myarcus and other flycatchers, that's another book that's coming out soon.
Different volume.
So they have Myarcus and kingbirds. I think that includes, well, I mean, it's sort of the bigger ones. So
I think it's smart, too, to break it up into more digestible chunks like they've done.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good concept.
Yeah.
In fact, taking something difficult and simplifying it is hard to do.
It really is.
Really hard to do. So.
Yeah. I have it. I was using it, especially on Western Impids. Last week. And it's a small book. It's not like a massive, you know, textbook or something.
Portable.
It really is. Yeah. And like you said, it's a very visually pleasing book with, like you said, the negative space, and they're not cramming a ton of stuff onto every page, and it's kind of separated in a logical way. Once you go through it, you kind of know what spot you're going to. And yeah, I like it a lot.
Yeah. I do feel like people really want to identify every single Impidinex they see, and that many of them should be left either as Impidinexpa or as something, you know, more generic.
But that's a sign of weakness, isn't it?
Apparently. People seem to think so. I'll say, the other day I had a bird here just down the road from my house where I saw it and I was like, oh, cool, this is probably going to be a yellow-bellied flycatcher. Quick look at it, and you know, that's sort of a scarce migrant here. I usually see a couple annually, and it's always kind of a nice thing to see, you know. And it's a fairly narrow window that they come through, both in spring and fall. And I was pretty reasonably sure, based on the quick look that I had, that that's what it was going to be. And then I was like, okay, this thing has flown out and is perched in a spot where I can actually manage some photos. And at that point, you're not really looking at it as much as you're just trying to get some photographs. And mm-hmm. so I just shot, you know, a bunch of photos and got home, looked at them, fully expecting it to show what I perceived to be a yellow-bellied flycatcher. And the photos really seemed to show a least flycatcher. And it was just another illustration of, like, you know, I, you know, it's not always what you think it is. And in the field, you can lead yourself down the wrong path. And it's especially easy with these Impidinex. I just feel like many more are identified than are correctly identified.
Yeah. It is interesting how the photography aspect of identification rears its head like that, you know. And in the past, you might have just happily seen a yellow-bellied flycatcher and not had that photo to sort of look back upon it. Similar thing, I noticed, you know, this hurricane, tropical storm Hillary that just went through Southern California and into Nevada and so forth, a lot of thoughts of what things were, and then photographs and reassessments and, you know, trying to figure things out kind of in the haste of like everything was going on all at once kind of thing. People reporting birds from here, there, white rump storm petrels, dark rump storm petrels, which one is this, least, black, blah. And then photographs started coming out and people then kind of sorting through their ideas. And you could see some people reassessing, you know, kind of half a day later, sort of saying, you know, I think we actually saw this rather than what we thought, you know. Or interesting how that was happening real time. You could see the photography was so key to some difficult IDs when they're marine birds out of habitat. You know, they're not flying exactly right, or, you know, or
yeah.
Wind. Yeah.
And they're tough. I mean, like, having birded a few storms, it's some of the most thrilling birding you can do, if some of the most depressing at the same time. But, you know, as you say, they're in abnormal places. They're behaving abnormally, and often the photography is really challenging.
The photos
you're getting are often present a challenge themselves.
Things are interesting out here, though. We had three pelagics, two on the 19th of August, right? This was a Saturday that storm started kind of making inroads that day, but really it didn't really hit Southern California till Sunday and Monday into Monday, you know? And then we had a trip out of Bodega Bay on Sunday, the same day the storm was sitting down south. And we already were detecting all sorts of southern birds north because of the water temperature. In fact, we saw our first least storm petrels ever on our trips, like ever.
I saw the photos. Ever. It looks like you saw them really well too.
Yeah, really well. So that was really, really cool. The Murrelet show included, you know, in the end, I think Monterey had four, and we had, you know, actually after looking at photographs from Saturday, we had one out of Half Moon Bay and we had one out of Bodega of Guadalupe Murrelet, which is often the hardest. So
that's the tricky one.
So that's a tricky one. So a lot of things had moved north before the storm, probably not related to the storm. Then, so that was all really good stuff. I did wonder though about one bird that some folks got on the Sunday, the day the storm was hitting, was a black tern, which was offshore. Quite rare where we were seeing it. And that's one of the birds that sort of does displace during storms like this. And could it have displaced way ahead of the storm? You know, like in a sense, mm-hmm. gone north, sensing something. And then it was, you start wondering like how far the effect is of these storms. Exactly, you know. Because we weren't in winds from the south or any of that kind of stuff. We were just in local weather, right? But we did have some rain, which was unusual, and it was sort of part of one of the arms of the storm. So I was intrigued, perplexed, excited. There was a moment in time I thought, you know, I could just leave this pelagic trip and drive south all night and be at that storm, which at least one of the birders on our boat did that, you know, and was like next day reporting birds from the storm, you know, area. So, no, I was like, I'm too old for that. Things to do, you know, so.
I don't know if you would have seen out, I just saw this like right before we started recording, and I doubt it's related, but I'm not really sure to Hillary, the storm, but there was 100 miles from the coast in like south central Texas near the town of Freer. Somebody photographed like dozens of frigate birds all lined up on a wire like swallows. So I'd not seen anything like that before. And I was like, you know, I don't know if that's a different storm happening, but
there is a different tropical storm hitting right now in Texas. Okay. So
yeah,
maybe that's it.
And the That's pretty wild, though. And I know that those things sometimes get way out ahead of systems, right? And can turn up.
Yeah.
Because they're basically like a kite flying around, right? They got no body and all sorts of wing and tail. You know, a little bit of wind, they can go a long way.
I just saw a picture, I mean, minutes before we started talking, of a great frigate bird down in sort of mid-south Chile, which would be the first great frigate bird for the mainland, I think. And this is right after massive storms that have hit central Chile. So who knows where this bird came from and if it's associated with that weather, but it's crazy to think of displacement by various different systems going at the same time in different hemispheres within our American kind of continent. It's like, it's all over the place. It's like a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah. It's wild. More storms on the way, it sounds like. Been checking the NOAA site for storms every few days just to see what might be coming.
Yeah. I check water temperatures, and just today I looked, saw that Monterey, the offshore buoy, was at 66 Fahrenheit, which is way higher than normal. Like that is, you know, we're lucky if we ever get to 62, you know, on a warm water year, but 66 is essentially Southern California water. Now, you know, we're completely different set of birds could be in that, including least storm petrel. And there was one actually a couple of days after we saw it, or maybe the day after, they caught one on the Southeast Farallon Island at night. So there's probably multiple, all sorts of leasts around our latitude, which hasn't happened for a long time, like kind of the last big El Nino. So it's cool and weird and interesting and, you know.
Yeah. You guys had a couple Hawaiian petrels this weekend, right?
Oh, yeah. Hawaiian petrel. It's getting to be almost normal.
Right? I was like, that really got buried back there. Yeah.
I know. Yeah, a couple of Hawaiian. But I know you don't like Hawaiian pizza, so I don't know what you're bringing.
Oh, but I would love me a Hawaiian petrel. That's a whole different animal right there, Al. Mm-hmm. And I need it. I need a Hawaiian petrel. Yeah, not seeing
you need it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we saw two of them out of Bodega Bay. So that was on Sunday. And two, you know, about at least maybe an hour and a half apart. So probably different birds. Maybe. At least they don't, you know, the pictures don't show anything. They seem to show two different birds, slightly different face patterns. So, yeah. I just wonder what's going to happen this weekend. We have two trips again. So out of Half Moon Bay. So we're all hoping for leasts to be out there again, maybe a murrelet or two or something. So,
fingers crossed.
Exciting.
Yeah. Nice. I'm hoping to get offshore as well. We got a Hillstar Pelagic overnighter scheduled to go out of North Jersey, Point Pleasant. But I'm hopeful. Looking at what has been seen by some other boats regionally, I know Pattison and his gang. Chris Sloan and Kate Sutherland, they had a really beautiful Feas petrel this past week. And there's been, you know, white-faced storm petrels seen now from just about every boat that's gone offshore regionally. So, yeah, I'm really hoping it goes and that we get, like, good stuff. You know, like, our last trip to Maryland waters out of Delaware did real well. And it just seems like every boat that's going is getting some good stuff. So I'm hopeful our trip will go and get good stuff as well.
I do think Pattison made a good point, though, for these overnights. You know, there's sometimes a little bit, you got to rent out the boat for a longer period of time. So there's a, you know, little higher cost, but you got to subtract the amount of money you would have spent on a hotel.
It is a very good point.
Yeah.
Very good point. Very good point, right?
You know, I'm like 6 hours from Point Pleasant, and I think the same, because if I'm going to come over for a pelagic, I would spend the night somewhere the night before, and then you get back late enough that I'd probably spend somewhere the night after before I come back. But for this one, I'd drive over, leave on the boat, and drive home the next night. So it kind of saved me two nights to stay somewhere.
Yeah. There you go.
All you need is that beanbag chair or a nice bedroll.
Beanbag chair.
That's what I'm bringing. I'm bringing a beanbag chair. Yeah. I got one of those. It's like meant for the boat, basically. A little beanbag chair. I'll melt into that thing, hopefully. And, you know, be woken up by, you know, the cries of a tropic bird or something. I don't know. Yeah.
Let me ask you, I haven't been on this kind of thing, you know, since we do 8-10 hour trips here at the most. Do they have breakfast? Do you bring your own breakfast, or is there like a galley where they cook up stuff for you?
So this boat has a galley. There will be like breakfast sandwiches, cheeseburgers, kind of standard grilling fare available for purchase. We advise folks to bring food as well, because, you know, that kind of fare is not always what everybody is looking for, and maybe shouldn't be having three meals, or, you know, a day like that. It's sort of both is that, you know, you bring a stash of your own food, and then if you feel like a burger or a breakfast sandwich or something, you can have one made up. So
I'm going to phone that boat without you knowing and say that this gang really loves Hawaiian pizza, and you should just load it up with Hawaiian pizza. That's all they eat. That's all they eat, this gang.
Oh, God. If that happens, I will probably eventually just have to eat some of the pizza just out of, you know.
Right. And I'm saying those who don't eat Hawaiian pizza really love tomato pie. So,
God,
stock up.
Maybe you could make like a sandwich out of like one slice tomato pie, one slice Hawaiian pizza, and eat it sort of like a weird stromboli. And then maybe somehow it would just be okay, you know?
No, that's gross.
Yeah. Food for thought. Well, I think we should roll here, guys. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we will be back again real soon. Al, Molly, have a good one. Talk to everybody else soon.
Bye-bye.
See ya.